The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton, president of Etherton & Associates. And John, it's that time of year again, right? We have the NDAA. We're going to talk a lot about that and some really interesting provisions in the final language. We'll also talk Section 809 and Section 813, the panels that were that from last year's NDAA. And we'll talk a little bit about what's going to come up, what we see in our crystal balls for next year and the transition. But first of all, John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's a pleasure to be back.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. And I guess I'll just open it up by asking you to, you know, sort of give a high-level, 30,000-foot snapshot of the NDA with regard to acquisition provisions, and then we can dive down in some of the details.
Okay. First of all, let's talk process. The bill has passed the House and Senate. The president has not yet signed the bill. I think the expectations are the people I've talked to on the Hill that he will sign it, although there are some issues in there that they were had raised some concerns about in the earlier statements. A lot of people have said, well, when is the president going to sign it? Well, just a little lesson in process. The bill first has to be enrolled before it is sent to the White House, and at that point, the 10-day clock starts for the president to take some action, and I don't believe that's occurred yet. So we're watching that, but my assumption is that the bill will be signed. I think if you look at the bill, especially looking at Titles 8 and Title 18, but there are also significant provisions in Title 9 and some of the other titles as well dealing with acquisition policy. This bill has, I think, the largest number of consequential acquisition policy provisions of any authorization bill that I've ever seen, and I've been working on them since 1981. So there are a number of different areas in the bill that folks have talked about and we've discussed. Everything from the organization of the Department of Defense for oversight of the acquisition process, to acquisition of commercial items, to issues around contract type and acquisition strategy, and a number of other things, I think, intended to foster innovation, for example. There's some different approaches in the bill to do that. So there's quite a bit to talk about in this bill, and I think there's some things that will then, in my opinion, lead to what people look at next year.
John, there's a lot. There's so much stuff in this bill. It's amazing. I mean, I don't even know where to start, but I do know where we're going to start. I think we'll start with probably the most controversial or area, and that's the split of AT&L into two different entities. Can you talk a little bit about that and what it is first, and then why?
Okay. The final language in the bill basically would take the Office of the Undersecretary for Acquisition Technology and Logistics and split it into two separate undersecretaries, one for research and engineering. I think the other one is acquisition and logistics.
Acquisition and sustainment.
Sustainment.
Yes. Right,
dealing with logistics issues. This started out as a Senate proposal. The idea in the Senate was their approach to innovation, which has been a major concern for both the folks in the Department of Defense as well as folks on Capitol Hill. And the House and Senate had different ways of approaching this. The Senate approach was to essentially organize around raising innovation as a higher priority or higher profile issue in the portfolio of the undersecretary overseeing acquisition. The Senate approach originally started with the idea that they were going to organize major defense acquisition programs and research and development and engineering sort of in one undersecretary, and then have the sustainment issues and the sort of business of managing the acquisition process in another undersecretary. This evolved quite a bit in conference, and where they ended up was really taking the focus on the research and development portion, and really placing all of those eggs in the research and engineering undersecretary basket, and then taking the other acquisition, including the other functions of acquisition on major programs, as well as some of the business oversight, the contract management, that sort of thing, and putting it in a separate undersecretary position, which would also have significant authority over nuclear programs and a number of other things. So this really looks a lot to me like what we had before the Packard Commission recommendations in 1985 and 1986 were implemented as part of the broader Goldwater-Nichols effort. And so I think what they're intending to do is to really focus a lot more attention on the imperatives of innovation, research and development, and maintaining our technological edge going into the future. Now, a couple of things I would say also about this. This does not go into effect until February of 2018. So this entire 2017 will be under the old organization. There are also a number of undersecretary positions, which were, or assistant secretary positions, rather, that were eliminated by this division, the idea here being to cut the size of the staffs, cut the size of the organizations, and to streamline things a little bit. But if you read the report language, you do get the impression, at least I do, that there's still a lot to be sort of fleshed out on this in terms of how it's going to work, what the roles and responsibilities are, and what additional things need to be considered. And a lot of that sort of requirement of sort of developing that strategy and policy is going to fall on the incoming administration. So I think this is going to very much a work in progress. I think you'll see some additional actions taken, I suspect, in the FY18 defense authorization bill next year, before all of this settles into concrete in 2018.
Is the February time frame that, you know, when it goes into effect, is that an ambitious? I mean, to your point about there's a lot of moving parts here and things to be figured out, and they have, you know, 2017 to do it. Is that an ambitious schedule? Is it realistic?
I think it's ambitious, but I think it's also a little bit problematic because you're timing that with a new incoming administration. Once people get settled into place, they may have their own views about how you organize around innovation and acquisition, and that may change or informs, or at least some proposals for changes that may come next year to this. So I think what it does is create a lot of uncertainty at the very top as to how the functions are going to be parsed out among different offices and what you're sort of seeking people is part of the incoming administration to do. So I think it raises a number of different issues, but I think it's very unsettled, and I'm not sure it'll be completely settled by February 20th.
But it's not going to go backwards to one.
I mean,
a little crystal ball here.
I don't think that certainly doesn't seem to be the direction. I think what the intent here is also is to get somewhat of a control around organizations and functional offices and things like that. This is an approach to do that. That seems consistent with what the incoming administration also wants to do in terms of their broader management.
When you say that, is from your perspective, is that the idea that, you know, some of these offices were too big to manage?
Yeah.
So they want to break them up a little, make it a little more, you know, provide a framework that might lend itself to more effective implementation and management?
I think what you have are a reduced span of control for the undersecretary so that they actually are going to be in a position to get control of the organizations that they oversee. I think one of the biggest criticisms that I've heard consistently about the acquisition technology and logistics undersecretary position is that the span of control was so broad over so many different functions that it was very difficult for one person or even one person and a small staff to truly oversee and integrate all of those different functions. I think the idea here is that you would have spans of control that would be more realistic with an individual or a small staff to be able to control.
Okay, and so there's some interesting language in there. The reorganization gives precedence to the Undersecretary for Defense for Research and Engineering over the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Sustainment. What's that all about?
Well, I think it's going to be a question of if you have disagreements between the two offices on how to proceed on some decision that maybe affects both portfolios. The way I read that language is that it would essentially give a slight edge to the Research and Engineering Undersecretary's views over the Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment. So, you know, there are also some protocol issues and some other things associated with that. It may not be anything more than symbolism, But I think in a case where you do have a more fundamental disagreement, that before it gets moved up to the Deputy Secretary of Defense, I think there would be a little bit of an edge that would give to the Research and Engineering Undersecretary.
Okay, and you know, looking at the last 2 years or even before, this is a piece of the puzzle, right? I mean, it's been laying out flexibilities and authorities in the name of trying to, you know, streamline, get innovation, you know, attract, quote, non-traditional companies. Now they're changing the structure to reflect some of the process that they put out there, right? Is that what's going on here?
I think that's part of it. I also think that what you're seeing, if you look at this in relationship to the organizations that are still in place at the services level, there you have a more unified organization on the acquisition side. I think this also reflects some of the direction that took place in the 2016 authorization bill, which basically sort of devolves more of the responsibility for day-to-day program management and requirements and things like that back to the services.
Back to services, yeah. Right. Yeah, well, John, on that note, we do have to take our first break. My guest today is John Etherton. He's the president of Etherton & Associates. And when we come back, we'll be talking some more about the NDAA. There's interesting, all kinds of interesting procurement language in there that I'm sure folks are looking forward to hear about. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton. John is president of Etherton & Associates, and it's that time of year again. We're talking NDAA. And John, we talked quite a bit the last section about the reorganization of AT&L, which does reflect this sort of organizing around innovation and seems to me to be a piece of the puzzle we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years in terms of language in the NDAAs. But let's talk a little bit more, and this, I think, actually, dovetails just nicely with that. And we're going to talk about some of the new procurement provisions in the NDAA. And one that really struck me almost immediately is the cost accounting standards. Now, that might put people to sleep, but I think it's a big deal what they've proposed. Can you talk about it?
Sure. Again, there was a little bit of an evolution here in a provision that started out in the Senate bill. The Senate bill actually would have created a separate standalone defense cost accounting standards board that really would take over a lot of the functions of the current cost accounting standards board that works for the government wide. What they've done in this language, in the final version of it, was basically to, yes, they have created a defense cost accounting standards board, but what I see the function of that board doing, rather than being sort of a standalone, separate entity with its own sort of scope of power, it's more responsible for looking at the specifics of the Department of Defense acquisition process and implementing the cost accounting standards and that, or sort of helping direct the cost accounting standards implementation in light of that, but also looking at ways to try to make sure that those standards are implemented in the defense side with a greater reliance as possible on generally accepted accounting principles, the things that apply in the commercial world, which is a new sort of a new approach, and I think is intended to cut the overhead costs as much as possible for companies that are doing business with the Department of Defense. So that's a pretty significant change, but I see the Defense Cost Accounting Standards Board in that light almost acting as sort of an ombudsman in that kind of a role for the defense space. In terms of looking at those cost accounting standards, making recommendations back to the larger board, and also working implementation to try to do it more consistently with the GAAP ideas.
Right. So, but it seems to me it's a pretty big deal, and it's a statement about not just reducing, overhead or costs, but attracting commercial firms.
Correct.
If the cost accounting standard board has to work to reconcile the federal cost accounting standards with generally accepted accounting principles, that's getting more commercial-like, is
Correct.
It not?
Absolutely.
And that's a big deal. It could be a big deal, couldn't it?
It could be a very big deal. I think it could make the environment a little more attractive for companies that may have a footprint in both spaces, for example, or may be in a position where they could be subject to coverage under the cost accounting standards, make it a less intimidating environment. But I also think it helps the companies that are currently in the space, that gives them a little more ability to reduce some things that may be within the company duplicative, where they've got different systems for the same requirements. So I think there's a broader benefit even than something dealing with non-traditionals.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
Yeah,
absolutely. So some of the other procurement provisions in the NDA, and another one that struck my eye was about low-cost, technically acceptable approach and what the department's new rules are. Can you talk about those?
Sure. Ever since Better Buying Power 1.0 and the direction to increase the use of lowest price technically acceptable, there's been a big concern in industry that that has become somewhat of a default for a number of reasons, not only from the Better Buying Power standpoint, but also for the fact that an LPTA approach tends to be less susceptible to a protest, probably easier to defend if there's an inspector general or other kind of oversight review of the procurement. And so there's been a lot of concern that there were a lot of very complex services type contracts that were purchased using LPTA that where it was really kind of an inappropriate mechanism. So we have language now in the, and this was actually, a version of this was in both the House bill and the Senate bill, so that this was fairly widespread concern, that essentially mandates the use of a oversight, basically says that there's several classes of services procurements that are, in the view of the Congress, or it's inappropriate to use LPTA, and for procurements that are proposed to use LPTA in those spaces, that there be a higher level approval required depending on the value of the contract. So that's a pretty significant change. I think people, though, need to recognize that that will apply primarily in cases where people are designing the acquisition process up front, not necessarily apply to things that may evolve once the acquisition strategy has been selected. So there may still be some issues around, you know, what people feel it is or is not LPTA. But I think that is the first time Congress has really come out and asked for something more than a study, where they made an emphatic decision to say, this is the process that we want you to follow, and it is, in our view, generally inappropriate for this broad range of these types of procurements.
Yeah, and I'm just curious about this, because, you know, when I saw this, you know what I immediately thought of? I thought of Encore 3 and the LPTA for a $17.5 billion IT services contract that involved, as best as I read in the RFP and feedback I got, some fairly sophisticated services. Mm-hmm. And I could, you know, never understand that. And I mean, that might have been the high... But maybe that's the high watermark of LPTA, and now it's going to recede, given this language. So another area that I think folks will be very interested in is the bid protest authority and the change in the dollar threshold there. What happened?
Well, it's interesting. One of the issues that occurred was the expiration of the authority to protest task orders for civilian agency multiple award contracts. At the end of September. So there was this sort of gap where you had the authority in place for the Department of Defense, and it didn't exist at all. Sort of it expired for the civilian agencies. That was fixed in this language, although the language is not retroactive. It does put will put back in place, assuming the president signs the bill, the authority to protest task and delivery orders contracts. Below, I think it's the $10 million threshold. But the interesting thing there is there was also language that it wasn't really talked about too much in the Senate bill that basically said if you had a sort of viable ombudsman process in place, that there didn't necessarily have to be a protest authority at all for at least the DOD side of the House. That language was dropped, but what you have now is an increase in the threshold for task orders for which you can protest on the defense side. So they've gone from 10, I think, $10 million to $25 million. So you now have different thresholds depending on which agency is the holder of the contract vehicle. which I think is going to be a subject of probably some conversations in the future. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but I think it is notable that we're seeing, starting to see a much more marked divergence between the rules that apply to civilian agency procurements versus those that apply in the Department of Defense. And I think that's reflected in some of the other provisions as well.
Do you think this, in your view, I have my own opinion, do you think this bid protest threshold, it attaches to the money, follows the money? And why? What I mean by that is if DOD engages GSA FedSIM to do a procurement on their behalf using DOD money, GSA is a civilian agency, what's the bid protest threshold? Is it GSA as a civilian agency $10 million? Or is it DOD because it's money and it's $25 million? Do you have any sense?
I would say that, to me, it would be the holder of the contract vehicle, but that's just a personal, off-the-cuff opinion. I think the thing to look at, though, is how the agencies treated the expiration of the civilian agency authority during this interim period, and whether, in fact, that expiration was reflected in the holder of the contract vehicle or whether that expiration followed the money. So, in other words, if DOD were using a civilian agency vehicle during this interim period, did in fact the task order protest authority continue in that case, or in fact had it truly expired for any task orders under that contract vehicle?
I believe there's a case just recently decided out there, GAO, that said that it took your approach, I believe.
Yeah.
But I've got to check that out. But it seems to me it's kind of interesting, and this is kind of getting down in the weeds a little, John. But, throughout my time at GSA and even in some of the regulations, it was put in there, you've got to follow the ordering activities rules and make sure everything, like domestic preferences and that all kind of thing. Now, with this, is that the case or not? So it'd be interesting to see how it all plays out, because GAO isn't the final arbiter on that, and I'm sure somebody will go to court on that if they see it to their advantage. My guest today is John Etherton of Etherton and Associates. We've been talking about the NDAA. When we come back, we'll finish up on the NDAA and we'll start talking about the Section 809 panel and the Section 813 panels that were authorized in last year's NDAA to look at DOD acquisition and the allocation of intellectual property rights and how the department handles that. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton, president of Etherton & Associates, and we're talking about Christmas comes once a year, and so does, I guess, the NDAA, right? although some many don't think it's bearing presents, I would think, in certain parts of the department.
Coal or presents,
right?
Depending on your point of view.
I used to get oranges in my stocking every year. That's what I remember.
Yeah.
I didn't get coal. But at least I was a good boy, right? But let's finish up on the NDA. There's so much there. I mean, we could do four or five shows on it.
Right.
But commercial item, there's continues to be this push towards two commercial item, commercial firms, quote, non-traditional firms. Can you talk about what's in this year's NDAA in that regard?
I think, primarily going back to the Senate, but there's also some language that emerged in the House bill with respect to the modular open systems architecture approach, which seemed to be reaching out a little bit to the non-traditional companies. But the idea being, on this quest for innovation or access to innovation, how do we break down the barriers and incentivize folks to do more work with non-traditional contractors? A theme that was started in earnest in the 16 bill and then I think picked up here. The real question then became, as we looked at the language, are we going to actually have two separate acquisition processes, one for the more traditional companies with the costs associated with that versus companies, the non-traditionals, that may not be subject to the same rules. I read a lot of the language in the final bill, in the conference bill, as an attempt to sort of reconcile those two positions a little bit, to essentially give something to everybody that would be sort of a lightening of the load as far as the overhead situation might be. We talked a little bit earlier about this use of generally accepted accounting principles and sort of opening up a door to that for everybody, basically. The business systems language that's also in the bill also, you know, gives a nod in that direction to try to use generally accepted accounting principles or use current auditing processes that are required for other things like Sarbanes-Oxley as a way of sort of streamlining the whole audit process. And this would be for everybody, traditional.
Eliminating government unique requirements.
Right,
right, right.
Right. There is clearly a direction here that basically says if you, you know, fall below a certain threshold in terms of the number of cost type contracts that you have, you would not be covered by some of these rules. But there's also, even in the case where you're covered by the rules, some attempt to provide some relief to some of the overhead costs and eliminate some of the duplication. So I think, you know, I think we're going to continue to walk down that road. But I think that was sort of a middle ground that folks were looking for. And you know, I think they've gotten closer to it in some of these provisions.
Right. So when you know, now we talk a little bit about this idea that we have diverging systems,
right?
Civilian versus DOD. Why is that significant?
Well, I think the question really is, do you want to have one face of government to industry so that someone can come into the acquisition process and say, whether I'm dealing with GSA, whether I'm dealing with HUD, whether I'm dealing with the Department of Defense or NASA, that I know that the rules are essentially going to be the same rules, okay? I don't have to account for differences in requirements on accounting. I don't have to account for differences, you know, different bid protest levels on task orders, that essentially we have all the same rules. That was a major initiative, I think, in the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act process in the mid-90s, was to essentially align those authorities for the civilian agencies in Title 41 with Title 10, so that as much as possible we could have language that would be, you know, close or identical. We've since seen a lot of divergence in statute between the laws governing the Department of Defense and the laws governing the civilian agencies. I asked the question a couple years ago at a conference with staff people from both the civilian oversight committees and the Department of Defense, the authorization committees, if that was still something that was worth pursuing. And everybody kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, we don't see necessarily why that even matters. Every agency has their own unique requirements, and maybe they should have more specialized authorities. And I think that is a function of the fact that the committees have sort of grown in number a little bit, you know, with the Department of Homeland Security and other places where they're getting their own sort of committees and oversight. But my belief is we need to return to something that's more consistent across the government.
Well, it's a kind of interesting, you know, that's the view of the folks you heard from, because so it's in it. To me, it's kind of inconsistent with the current approach, right? Because, okay, now the current approach is we need to make this more like commercial, so it's somewhat more consistent, right, from going, you know, from commercial to the government marketplace. But within the government marketplace, we're going to make it less consistent. So a portion of the market may be more like commercial, and maybe it's the biggest one, right? Maybe it's DOD, but but it's okay to have all these other inconsistencies. That seems kind of, you know, there's a gap there intellectually. Well, it seems to me.
I think though there are some institutional issues that are involved with this. It's not merely the intent of the people who put these things together that there be that divergence.
Uh-huh.
I think, for example, in the Senate, it used to be the case that when the Senate Armed Services Committee reported out their bill and it went to the floor, it could be amendable. There would be agreed amendments anywhere from 100 to 200 agreed amendments doing any number of things, including frequently taking provisions that came out of the committee's bill that were only applicable to the Department of Defense and making them government-wide.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We now have a situation when you get to the floor, if you didn't put something in the bill during the markup process in committee, institutionally now it's very difficult to amend the bill, even with amendments that have been cleared. If you go back and look at the floor consideration over the last couple of years in the Senate, what you see is very few amendments ever got added to the bill on the floor, even though my understanding is that many of them were cleared, and there were any number of reasons why people, the leadership or whatever, decided not to allow these amendments on both sides. But I think part of this is the fact that you just don't have a clear mechanism anymore for doing a lot of things government-wide that started out in the committees as things that were only applicable to the Department of Defense. It may take a, you know, a different effort, a standalone effort to sort of affect that reconciliation if people think that it's worthwhile. So that is a factor in all this.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too. And there's one, there's this, you know, this, you know, here's a real life example in this NDAA provides for the ability to award services, multiple award task and delivery orders, contracts for services. And you don't have to consider price as long as I understand it, award to responsible.
Well, you also have the expectation that you're going to have task orders that are going to be competed.
Right, competed. Right. But, you know, civilian, on the civilian side, you know, there isn't a similar statutory authority. Right. I mean, I think GSA has that authority for its schedules program, and it could do it if it wanted to. You know, that creates this disconnect as well, I think, in terms of how price is treated and services requirements.
Well, and how much work a contractor has to do. To, you know, get a contract award, a multiple award contract or a schedules contract, for example.
So on one hand, while they're pretty clearly trying to address having duplicative systems, one for commercial, one for government, that you could see creep in, I have to have a system for civilian agencies versus DOD or even more, right?
Right.
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out. My guest today is John Etherton. He is president of Etherton & Associates. We're finished with the NDA, John. I thought you're happy about that. But when we come back, we'll talk a little about the Section 809 panel, DOD acquisition advisory panel that's looking at DOD acquisition operations. And I think they've kind of expanded their scope of what they're looking at. Mm-hmm. And the Section 813 panel that's looking at intellectual property rights and how that's managed at the department as well to make recommendations there. And then we have a little time, we'll look in our crystal balls for next year. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton. John is president of Etherton & Associates. And this segment, after looking at the NDAA, we're going to look at some products from last year's NDAA, in particular two acquisition advisory panels that are put together to look at various aspects of DOD's interface with the private sector. That's a good way to put it, huh? Mm-hmm. So first, the Section 809 panel, John, talk about what is it, its scope, its mission, and current status of what's going on there.
The 809 panel was created sort of as modeled after the Section 800 panel from the FY91 bill, which looked at acquisition statutes and did a thorough review and made recommendations. It was a two-year effort. Their focus was on statutes. They put out a product, and it was basically what then later became largely the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act, and even some of which ended up in the follow-on Clinger-Cohen Act. This is an attempt now, after all the time that has taken place since the early 90s, to take another look. The focus, though, here is not on statutes solely. It is also on regulation. Because there is a sense that a lot of things in regulation don't necessarily have a source in statute, so the committees on the Hill wanted a broader view. This group has been formed. They started officially in August. They are not, interestingly enough, a federal advisory committee for purposes of a lot of the requirements on public meetings and other kinds of things, although they've done a lot of their work in the public domain and I think intend to continue to do that. That they've gotten a number of very senior, well-experienced experts but also have a lot of interesting and provocative ideas that they want to look at and recognize how the world has been changing. They have a two-year mandate, so they will be required under statute to get their final report to the Congress, or I think first to the Secretary of Defense sometime in August of 2018. But they also are required to have an interim report out in the fall of next year. So I don't see their work necessarily impacting anything that happens in the FY18 authorization cycle, but I think it could be very fundamental to what occurs in the FY19 cycle. They are looking at things like commercial item acquisition, not surprisingly. They are talking to companies who absolutely positively refuse to do any direct business with the government. And prefer to work through resellers or through other companies and see what's sort of behind all of that. They're looking at programs that have gone particularly well and what were the factors that sort of determined those procurements or those programs and how to sort of figure out to bottle that and spread it out across the system as a whole or why that can't occur to the system as a whole. And they're also looking at the acquisition workforce, which is a perennial issue, and just trying to understand the relationship between a lot of the regulation in the FAR and the Defense Acquisition Regulation Supplement and things dealing with what's in statute itself. So, you know, to what extent have the regulations gone beyond the requirements of statute and maybe even deviated in some way?
Yeah. It's like, get back to the floor rather than they keep you know, sort of raising the ceiling there or something, right? So they have an interim report in the fall of 2017.
Correct.
Right. And so you're saying you don't see any of that. That's too late, right, to get into
Well, it depends on, you know, we have a process now where we're going to have a
right. It's Christmas
until April.
Right.
And then I guess at some point, hopefully shortly thereafter, we start with the FY18 process, but much later than normal. And so maybe there is a possibility for some, depending on how late the process starts next year, but I really don't expect to see much impact until the following year.
Okay. So the Section 813 panel,
right.
What
yeah.
is that
well,
they one
are,
up to?
They are much more narrowly focused and have a much shorter time frame. They are looking at the statutes in Title 10, 10 U.S.C. 2320 and 2321, and the related statutes dealing with rights and technical data and intellectual property. And this has been an issue that people have been fighting about since the mid-1980s, and the statute has been getting progressively more nuanced and larger from the very relatively short statute that was put in place in 1984. They are now in the process of working through specific recommendations. They are a Federal Advisory Act, Committee Act panel, so they're work is being done in the public domain. In fact, they have a meeting tomorrow and a meeting on Wednesday over at the Pentagon, and folks can even call in if they want to listen in on the proceedings. They're both going to be all-day sessions. I expect, will have their work done probably in the first quarter of 2017, and there may be some impact then again on the FY18 process. Interestingly enough, there is language in this year's authorization bill, the one we've been talking about, Section 805, which does make some very fundamental changes to the current statutes and sort of walks back some of the changes that were made in the FY 2012 bill. This is a moving target. I think this is going to be a fairly volatile area because, interestingly enough, the 809 panel folks I've talked to have said they are also going to look at these statutes. And so I think that we're going to have multiple consideration of different, how do you balance the government's interest in intellectual property for purposes of sustainment and other purposes with the interest of industry and being incentivized to develop new technology and offer that to the government. And so I think this is going to be a long-term conversation that's going to take place in a number of different venues.
Right. In that regard, I mean, it's a push and pull kind of thing, right? I mean, it seems to me we go back and forth on this repeatedly. It's a tough issue.
I will give you my take on it in a nutshell, and that is that the government is in a position, when they are in a position to have the greatest negotiating leverage, it's at a time when they simply don't know what they need because they haven't really gotten a good understanding of their sustainment needs in these programs.
Right.
It's very early in a program. So the challenge I think that the government side has is how do they take the time when they've got the greatest leverage and tie it to the time when they're going to have the greatest need and ensure that they've got the rights at that time. And that's really the challenge. And I think for the industry, it's an issue of predictability.
Yes,
so that they know that they get the return on their investment and they can make, you know, funding decisions and investment decisions based on that, and that they know that their rights are going to be protected at each stage once they finish that negotiation with the government. So I think they're different imperatives, but I think we'll see how much they can be reconciled, at least in the format of this government industry panel.
Well, John, you know, we only got a couple minutes left, so we didn't save a lot of time to talk about like next year or transition. So, I mean, what strikes you going into the new administration, new Congress, all one party?
Well, I think that it'll be an interesting situation because I think for the administration incoming, I think everything is going to be on the table, and I think some of the communications that we've seen in the last few weeks sort of indicate that, and that there's going to be a real desire to wring as much savings out of the system as possible to allow for some of the larger investments that people have foreseen, especially in the Department of Defense. So I think that's going to be a big challenge. But you also have sort of a momentum building that has been building now for a couple years on the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee on the things that they're going to be looking at. And I think if you look at the reports that are in both the report language of this year's authorization bill as well as the bill language, it will give you a very clear sense of what, in fact, is on the plate for them next year. And I think it's areas like operations and sustainment. I think it's services contracting. I think it's the use of IDIQs and contract type. I think it's going to be another big issue. I think you're also going to be looking at having to design a new process for information technology acquisitions. The current statute governing major automated information systems in Chapter 144A of Title 10 in this new bill is set to expire entirely in September of next year. So they have to design a new process, and they have to align the offices in Department of Defense to oversee that process. So I think you already see sort of the outlines of what the homework assignments that everybody has put out there for next year, both for the Congress and for the executive branch. And we mentioned the organization issues, which I think is still on the table as well for next year. So a lot of things that will have to be figured out and worked through.
Well, John, that just means I'm going to have you back on the show. Talk about how those things all shake out, right?
Always a pleasure.
I want to thank my guest today, John Etherton. He's president of Etherton Associates. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf. Only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.